Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to a November 10 segment from the Kentucky Water Fuel Museum. Tonight we have a very special guest, namely Wayne Green, who is with us at this time. Are you not Mr. Green?
No, I am Mr. Green.
Very good. Well, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you.
And why don't we begin as we usually do with your early background. Perhaps you could tell our listening audience where you're from and what your comeuppance was like.
Well, like a lot of people, I started out as a baby.
Okay, very well.
And I was born in Littleton, New Hampshire. And my dad was born in Littleton, New Hampshire. And his mother before him was born in Littleton, New Hampshire.
How do you like that? Well, I went to New Hampshire for the first time just a couple months ago.
Mm-hmm.
And really enjoyed it. Went to Portsmouth.
Okay, well, we have a wonderful state. Matter of fact, I publish a magazine called New Hampshire To Do, What There Is To Do in New Hampshire. And it's a monthly, 64 pages full color, and we are just packed with the number of things that there are, the exciting, fun things there are to do in New Hampshire.
Okay, so you were born and raised there. What about your education, your early life?
Well, I didn't say I was raised here.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah,
well,
your accent actually reveals that, doesn't it?
Well, I've got different accents.
Okay.
It depends on where I'm talking, you know. I lived in New York for 30 years.
Okay.
And, yeah, I can talk New York pretty good. As a matter of fact, I can walk down Flatbush Avenue and they don't know I don't live there.
Isn't that funny?
Sightly, yeah. So,
well, I've done the same thing living in Kentucky for 26 years. As one elderly gentleman that I interviewed a couple years ago said, he says, I speak cornbread.
Right. And I've been visit Minnesota, too.
Uh-huh.
At any rate.
What about your early education? What about
well,
that?
I was very fortunate in that my mother was 80 years ahead of her time, and she fed me hot cereal with no sweetening. We had no sugar, no jam, no jelly, no white bread, just whole wheat bread and whole wheat toast. And eggs were what we call soft boiled, which means that most of the yolk or the yolk was raw and most of the white was raw. And so I grew up with perfect teeth. And we'd go to the dentist once a year for a checkup, and they'd bring in everybody from the office and said, look at these perfect teeth.
So good nutrition in childhood is a very important thing.
It's very important, right.
Well, that's good for people to hear because we are being inundated with junk food that's really ruining the health of the people.
Well, you've got this ADHD, and if they just stop feeding the kids sugar-frosted loops, they'd stop jumping around all day.
Yeah, and something even worse than sugar has come on the scene, this high-fructose corn syrup.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't believe that I go into a convenience store to get something to drink, and I cannot find a liquid beverage that does not have that in it as the second ingredient.
Oh, you haven't tried water yet.
Yeah. Well,
can I highly recommend water?
Well, I like water, too.
Distilled water, by the way.
Oh, really?
Yes, really. There
okay,
isn't any of that stuff in water that in tap water that you want other than the water itself. You don't want the fluoride, that's for sure. You don't want any lead or other things that are in there. Yeah, you get your minerals all from your food. And
so you are against heavy metal then?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Sure. So anyway, oh, yeah, I was very healthy as a child. And I had a particularly significant event when I was about, 12 years old, 13 years old. My grandfather died, and a few months later, I went to church one Sunday to go to Sunday school, and a guy came in with a box of radio parts, and he asked my friend Alfie if he wanted them, and Alfie said, nah, maybe Wayne wants them. So I said, you bet. And I took the box of radio parts. Now, whoever heard of somebody going into a church with a box of radio parts? You know, come on.
Or you think this
I don't think this ever happened. I think this was an angel.
This is divine providence, huh?
This is it. And I took it home, and there was an article in Popular Mechanics on how to build a cigar box radio. and it had a lot of the parts that I had. And I built it, and the number one disaster of my life happened. It worked.
Well,
I was hooked.
That had a negative impact on the rest of your life, huh?
I was hooked.
Yeah.
And I spent about the next 30 years at the workbench.
Just out of curiosity, did you actually build it in a cigar box?
Yeah.
Interesting, because you know that this water-powered car that I had in my museum,
mm-hmm.
the electronics were actually installed in a cigar box.
I'll be darned.
Yeah, isn't that funny?
Well, my grandfather killed himself smoking cigars. But at any rate, that got me started.
Mm-hmm.
And that
your
has...
life has pretty much been largely influenced by ham radio, is that it?
Oh, sure. When World War II came along, you've read about it in the history books. Well, I was right at the right age. It was on my 17th birthday that they started World War II over in Europe. And, of course,
year
2 years later...
Hmm? Was that 1942?
That was 1939.
Okay, 39 is when it began in Europe.
Yep.
Okay.
And then 1941, Roosevelt managed to get us attacked by the Japanese. And he had to work hard to do it, but he did it. And there's a good book on that subject by Stinnett.
What
explains
that?
How Roosevelt forced the Japanese to attack us.
Really?
Yep.
What was the title of that book?
Day of Deceit.
Day of Deceit, okay.
Mm-hmm.
So is that a conspiracy theory, or is that...
No, that's a conspiracy fact. Stinnett spent years breaking through all the protection around that.
So you're saying that what is commonly taught in history classes about the beginning of World War II, the causes of it, you're saying that that's false?
That's right. Now, what happened was that Hitler started the war over in Europe, and he conquered... all of Europe except for England, and England was on the ropes. He could have gone over there and done a job on them. And Roosevelt wanted to protect them, but 85% of the Americans were against our getting into the war in Europe, and he needed something to break that. So he went to work on the Japanese and closed off their oil supplies, and he knew exactly when and where they were going to attack at Pearl Harbor. And before that, he got rid of his good general and his good admiral and replaced them with dopes and got us attacked. And, of course, he made sure that no ships were there that were any of any importance. We lost a couple battleships, which, you know, were for really from a previous war. And this war was aircraft carriers, and he made sure that none of them were anywhere near, et cetera.
Very interesting. Now, there are people making similar claims about the attack on 9/11.
Mm-hmm. I think you could document a very good case for our having a Pearl Harbor II.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to get into that now. We have more.
No, let's not do that.
But let's go on from there.
But I have read up. I've read over 10 books on the subject and so forth. And
okay.
All making very good sense.
Yeah. Well, there's something weird going on. People seem to sense that.
So World War II came along. I was 19 when we got into it, and I was prime bait for that. So I volunteered for the Air Force, and they said, "Oh, you've got asthma and hay fever. We don't want you." So I stopped bringing that up, and I got an invite to go to visit a Commander Bourne down at the Anticosti Naval Laboratories just outside of Washington, D.C. And I got an interview down there, and he said, "Oh, I want you to work in my labs. I want you in here for research and development. But first you have to go to radar school." And I said, "Fine." So I joined the Navy and went to radar school for 9 months and came out number one. And at that time, I said, "Well, you know, yeah, I'm supposed to let Commander Bourne know that I'm graduating so he can cut my orders to come back to Anticosti and work in the lab." I said, "But it's better that somebody that's married and has kids does that, and I should probably be out there fighting. And I don't like taking orders, so I had a choice either of going to a destroyer where I'd be in charge or a submarine where I'd be in charge." And I decided, well, a submarine's more dangerous, and, you know, big deal. And it pays more. So I volunteered for submarine duty.
Huh. And what were you doing on the sub?
I was an electronic technician. I ran all the radar, the sonar, the radio equipment, kept it all serviced and so forth, and operated it under battle conditions, etc.
Wow.
And I spent 5 war patrols on the USS Drum, and we were one of the top scoring submarines in the service. And I wrote a book about it.
Is that right? And yeah. What was the title of that book?
Submarines in World War II.
Very well. And what ocean were you in at that time?
Oh, the Pacific.
Yeah.
Oh, sure. No, we were sinking Japanese ships right and left.
Very interesting.
And we came very, very close to being sunk a few times ourselves.
Through depth charges?
Or? Oh, sure. Hundreds of them.
Hmm. Wow.
And also through misadventure. There was one time when we had these new electric torpedoes. It was the first time. Before that, they were always steam-driven torpedoes. And we got a perfect target with 3 ships lined up. And we sent all 6 of our Ford torpedoes there. And the Navy said, you have to set them for 6 feet depth. So we did. And, of course, they all went under the ships and exploded beyond. But that started the... protective ships. They're chasing us. And on the surface at night, we were able to do about 23 knots, and the destroyer escorts could do about 40 knots. So we were going all ahead flank, and then as they were closing in, we had to dive. Well, we'd done hundreds of dives and up to full speed ahead, but never at flank speed. And my job when we dove was to go from the radio shack and run through the control room, run up through the forward torpedo, forward battery into the forward torpedo room, and lower the sound heads, and then go back up to the conning tower and operate the sound equipment. Well, as I was running through the control room, I heard the fellow on the bow plane say, the bow planes are stuck on full dive, and I can't get them off. And we had about a 30-degree down angle by that time.
And that's quite excessive, isn't it?
And we're in what was called a 300-foot boat. It was built to go to a maximum of 300 feet deep, so with 3/4-inch hull. And so I kept going through the forward torpedo room, forward battery up to the forward torpedo room, and yelled at the guy, said, hey, get a crowbar and pry these bow planes off full dive. They're stuck. And so they quick dropped everything and got down there, and 3 guys got there and pried them off. By this time, we were going down at about a 45-degree angle and heading down fast.
Goodness.
Nobody was on the phones at the time. If I hadn't been there right at that time and heard them and got up there, we'd have sunk. And we leveled off at 450 feet, and no boat had ever been that low before.
Yeah, 3/4-inch hole really isn't that thick, is it?
Right.
For that
and
kind of
so, you know, rivets were popping and so forth. But
wow, that must have been scary.
But, yeah.
And that was never put into film? It sounds like a great movie.
No, my boat did make film in a book, in a movie called Destination Tokyo, where the boat went into Tokyo Harbor and sat there and waited for them to launch an aircraft carrier. And as soon as they launched it, they sank it and then dashed back out.
Huh. What a daring mission that was.
Right. So, we had a good time anyway.
Could it be that the mishap with the steep descent actually saved you from the approaching boats?
Well, it helped, that's for sure, because the depth charges rained down and they had no clue that we would be that far down.
Yeah, that probably saved you, actually.
Might have.
Yeah. Okay, so what happened next after the war?
Well, anyway, after the war, they wanted to make me a commander and put me in charge of the submarine school at New London, and I said, no thanks, Navy life is not what I want. So I went back to college. I'd done 2 years at college before that at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. And I got in there because in high school, they had career advisement people came in and gave us tests and so forth. And they said, hey, you've got the highest mechanical aptitude we've ever measured. You've got to be an engineer. I said, well, I'm a ham. And they said, okay, good. Become an electrical engineer. So I went to Rensselaer, which was one of the two top technical universities, for 2 years. And then the war came along, and the military figured that people were more important in the military than in school. So I spent the next 4 years in the Navy. And then I got out and went back to school. And when I got out of school, it was a choice of working for a big corporation, which were all recruiting all over the place, and I knew I didn't want to do that. So I went to work for a radio station down in North Carolina as an engineer announcer. I had a wonderful time.
Very interesting.
And, well, I...
Now, during this time, you had already written a book or two, or...?
No, I didn't start doing that until much later.
Okay.
I got involved with amateur radio teletype, and that was so much fun. That was the first digital communications. And that was so much fun that I said, hey, more people want to know about this. And I looked around, and nobody was doing anything, so I was working at that time as a... producer-director in a television station in Cleveland. And they had a mimeograph machine that wasn't doing anything. So I started a teletype newsletter, a teletype journal, so that I could get more people to have fun. I like to share things that are real fun.
Now, what did the mimeograph machine have to do with this, then?
Well, that was the way I was able to put out the journal.
Okay, so you were actually printing and mailing?
Sure.
And you were charging a subscription fee for that? Or?
Yep. I built up to over 2,000 subscribers.
International, or?
Yeah, sure.
Wow. How many pages was the journal?
Well, it went up to about 36 pages.
Okay.
And finally, I was doing all the drafting of the circuits and so forth on my drafting board and taking pictures with my grandfather's 5x7 plate camera.
Mm-hmm. And so you began publishing at what age was that? You were in your mid-20s by then? Or?
Well, let's see. That was 1950, so I was 27, 28.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And that was your first effort at publishing?
That's right.
But not your last, obviously.
No. Then I got fed up with working for other people, so I borrowed $1,000 on my car. And started my first company.
Okay, what was that?
And that was manufacturing loudspeaker cabinets for hi-fi nuts.
Really?
And I was one of those hi-fi nuts.
So you were building plywood cabinets?
Right.
Okay.
Out of 3/4-inch plywood.
Yeah, plywood was a new thing then too, wasn't it?
Fairly new, yep. And my cabinet took 1 4x8-foot sheet and to make a complete cabinet. And it had a better sound than anything else on the market at any price.
What did you call it?
It was called a Carlson enclosure because a fellow named Carlson, who had worked for me as an engineer, had invented a microwave antenna that worked over a wide band of frequencies. And I looked at it and I said, microwave and audio are the same wavelengths. This will make a speaker cabinet. And so we got together one summer and made one, and it was fantastic. And that's when I stopped working for anybody else and started. And 2 years later, I had 7 factories going.
Amazing. Now, did that morph into a different company that still exists, or did that go out of
business? What happened was that Carlson kept working for the Airborne Instrument Laboratories, and I built the business into a multi-billion-dollar business. And he came in one day and said, well, you know, the board of directors are you, me, and my wife, his wife, that is. And he said, we voted you out. And he locked the door.
That's amazing.
So, 7 months later, they were out of business. Because he didn't know how to run it, wouldn't take any advice.
Well, it served him right, huh?
Right. And at that time, CQ magazine, the ham radio magazine, I'd been doing a column for them on teletype. Said, well, I got the editor a better job with another magazine, and all of a sudden they had no editor, so I took on as editor of a ham radio magazine.
And what was
and what could be more fun than that?
Oh, yeah, that was right up your alley, wasn't it?
Oh, sure.
What was the circulation of that magazine?
Oh, it was about 50,000.
Okay, so that was quite a job for you.
Oh, yeah. Well, they had been losing money, and within a few months, I had them making a big profit.
You know, I need you to take a look at my business. It sounds like everything you touch turns to gold.
Well, I've done pretty well. I've started 35 successful publications down through the years, and two of them got to be the largest in the country.
Wow, and what would those be?
Well, when the first computer kit came out for hobbyists by a little outfit down in Albuquerque, New Mexico, called MITS, and they put out a little kit for computer nuts, and I got one, and I said, wow. And I said, this is going to be huge. And I got all of the computer books I could find, and I didn't understand them. They were all college texts. So I said, well, we need a magazine. And I thought up a name, a short, pertinent name, BYTE, Byte, which is one bit of information. And started a magazine called Byte.
Yeah, a young person today would say, this magazine bites.
Right. And it became the largest magazine in the country, running 800-900 pages a month.
Wow.
And Vogue magazine beat me out for second place. My 80 micro for the Radio Shack computer was only running 600-700 pages a month, 13 issues a year.
But that really does signify intense interest on the part of the reading public.
Well, we were growing at 50% a year for 7 years. And then the big guys, the billion-dollar publishers came in, and they made an offer I couldn't refuse. I said, either sell out or we'll put you out of business. Which would you prefer?
And that's the way they approach people, huh?
Right.
Now, do you feel like, I know we haven't gotten talking about alternative energy yet, but I feel like it's appropriate to ask.
Well, you asked about my background.
Yeah, and I mean, just because of what you just said, it makes me want to ask you, is this the same kind of tactic that's used when successful alternative energy technology surfaces?
Well, partly. They either buy them out or kill them.
Okay, so let's save that for a little later and keep on with your career path then.
Yeah.
Okay, so you became a publisher of, what did you say, 25-some magazines?
35 I've started, different ones.
And then what other businesses did you start in addition to publishing, or did you just continue publishing for the rest of your career?
Oh, well, I've done little things like importing computer stuff from Asia and so forth, and going over there. And I led trips over to Asia for 200 to 300 people every fall to go to the Asian electronic shows. And they had shows back-to-back in Japan, Korea, Taiwan, and Hong Kong. So you could take people over for about a two-week trip and hit four electronic shows.
So you would charter a plane and take groups of people there, is that it?
Right.
Wow.
Well, I worked with a travel agency, and they did all the work. I just led it.
No, it sounds like a lot of fun, though.
Oh, wonderful. You know, I got to visit Hong Kong every year, and Taipei, and Seoul, Korea, and Tokyo, and Osaka, and so forth.
And major things were happening at that time, too, weren't they?
You bet.
Every year for the past...
Sure. No, I saw all this coming. The first computer kit came on the market in January 1975, and by May I was getting the first issue of my magazine ready to go. And I have a tape of me giving a talk at an Atlanta Hamfest in January 1976, just a year later, describing today's laptop computer.
Wow. So you really have been at the cutting edge of technology.
Well, yeah. And before that, I did the cell phones. That was a ham hobby of extending the range of our handy talkies and our mobile units with what we call relay stations or repeaters on top of mountains and tall buildings. And I put one up in the local mountain here and made it so that any ham anywhere in mobile in New England could talk to any other one. And I was able to ski the mountains of New Hampshire and so forth with my little handy talkie and make telephone calls through the repeater anywhere in the world.
Which was quite a marvel at that time.
And so I began publishing articles on this, and I published hundreds of articles, and it helped the technology develop rapidly.
Because you whet people's appetite for it.
Yep. Well, we started out with about a half a dozen of those, and then 2 years later, we had over 8,000 of them around the country going, just on amateur radio. And then they went all over the world. When I was flying from Johannesburg up to Mbambani, I bet you don't know what country that's the capital of.
Mbambani?
Mm-hmm.
That's an interesting question. I'd be guessing.
Swaziland.
Swaziland.
Yeah.
But that's not even called Swaziland anymore.
Sure it is.
I thought that...
No, it's still Swaziland. I had a shirt made from there that I just got recently from Hayband.
The name wasn't changed to Burundi or something?
No.
Okay.
Still Swaziland.
All right.
But at any rate, I was flying from Johannesburg up to Mbambani and talking to the hams around South Africa by way of the Johannesburg repeater and all from the plane, and all of a sudden the Swaziland repeater came on, and I said, well, that's it. We're everywhere.
Isn't that something?
Well, at that time I was publishing all those computer magazines. I had one for the Apple called Insider, one for the Commodore called Run, and, of course, 80 Micro for the Radio Shack computer, microcomputing for the real technical nerds, and on and so forth. So they said, well, we want you to come down to South Africa and give the keynote talk down here at our computer conference. So I said, well, okay, as long as you'll make sure that I get a trip to Swaziland and Lesotho thrown in. They said, no problem.
Wow. You know, I would like to make a suggestion for your next publishing project if you're not done, and that is to produce a good alternative energy magazine, because there is not one in existence at this time that I know of.
Yeah.
There is no magazine that addresses the doable alternative energy, and I'm not talking about solar and wind, you know, but the stuff that really works and that...
Well, there's only one that really, really does the job. And I published a journal on that already called Cold Fusion.
Okay, why don't we talk about that now? How did
sure.
you get interested in Cold Fusion?
Because that's, you know, this is one of the big cover-ups. And we've got so many things. The public is so totally brainwashed. You know, they're all involved with the Red Sox, and they don't want to know anything else. But the cover-ups, the biggest one of all by far, of course, is health, where you can cure any illness with no drugs. Cancer, totally easily curable without fail, and so forth.
There's a very large industry that, or more than one actually, that benefits from people being sick.
Well, there's no industry that benefits from people being healthy.
Yeah, and so you follow the money.
So we're talking $3 trillion industry that depends on our being sick.
You know what's funny? I don't know about in your area, but here in Kentucky, there are chain drugstores going up on every street corner.
Mm-hmm.
They're putting up a Rite Aid or a
CVS and so forth.
CVS,
yeah. Sure.
As if to say that you know, this is a sick country and they're here to help us.
Yeah, right. And they call it healthcare. I love that. That's like calling the you know, what was the War Department is now the Department of Defense, and they've successfully defended us from all kinds of places.
Yeah. Well,
but anyway, that's the biggest cover-up, and Cold Fusion is another huge one.
Okay, so how did you first become interested in Cold Fusion?
Well, I got a call from a ham down in Texas, and he said there's going to be a Cold Fusion conference out in the Hawaiian Islands in next month, and why don't you be out there? So I went out.
Did you know what he was talking about? Did you know what he was talking about?
Well, I looked it up. Sure.
I mean, had you already heard of it?
Oh, sure, I'd heard about it, sure. Well, I heard about Pons and Fleischmann and so forth, and how it had been totally discredited.
And what was your gut feeling without having gone to a conference yet or whatever?
I'm used to things being covered up that are going to hurt an industry, so I wasn't real surprised.
Okay, so you had some feeling of it perhaps being a legitimate technology.
Oh, sure. And particularly, you know, the more I looked into it, it made sense. So at any rate, I went to the conference out there, and of course I got there a few days early so I could scuba dive all six Hawaiian Islands first.
Oh, boy. You got me envious now.
And then I listened to the technical papers, and it all made sense. And that's where I met Gene Malov, and he was there from MIT.
Was he still at MIT?
No, he just left them.
And maybe for the sake of those who don't know, perhaps you could fill them in on why he left MIT.
Oh, well, he got pretty angry with them because they did some a research project on cold fusion, proving that it worked, and then fudged the factors.
So
to protect to protect the money coming in for hot fusion research.
Interesting. So that was the motive behind their cover-up.
Sure. No, they didn't want to lose all that money that was coming in, particularly for hot fusion, which looked like it was never going to pan out.
Now, do you think that this same story can be repeated in all the major learning institutions in the country and even in the world? That funding is dependent on their cooperating with the people doing the funding in terms of what they reveal to the public?
Are you suggesting that money talks?
Huh? But we're
what a crazy idea.
Academia.
Oh, come on.
Withholding information from the public for the sake of their sponsors. Is that
right.
What you're saying? I mean, there's a lot of people who don't believe that that's possible. That
sure.
Institutions all over the world would, in collusion, not reveal something.
Well, boy, well, of course, they don't know about the FDA.
Yeah, immediately.
Which is about as crooked as you get.
So
at any rate,
you're saying that big money controls the information feed
sure.
to the public, whether it be healthcare, alternative energy, or whatever.
That's right. Now, these things, well, of course, scientists in general resist anything new, vigorously resist it. I don't think you can cite any new development that hasn't been fought vigorously first by the establishment.
The perception by the public is the exact opposite of that? That people think scientists are into learning and discovering, and they would
right.
be the first ones to brag if they had discovered something?
So anyway, we came along, and the head of the Department of Energy was Dr. John Huizinga, and he published a book called Cold Fusion, the Scientific Fiasco of the Century. And he got in touch with the patent office and got them to reject all cold fusion patent applications, which they're still doing today. And a couple of them sneaked through for Jim Patterson because he was a senior citizen and they had a separate branch, and apparently the people running that hadn't gotten the word.
So maybe you could fill the audience in with regard to Jim Patterson.
Well, he came along, and what he did was research this, and he had already gotten some patents on some little tiny plastic balls. And what he did was coat them with palladium or with nickel and then put them in water and pass an electric current through it. And when you pass an electric current through water, if you've done any scientific research, you know that it separates into hydrogen and oxygen and comes off as gases. So if you have a bunch of, say, nickel and coating these spheres or nickel powder, which gives you a very large surface area, and you pass the electric current through the water, the nickel is like a sponge, and it sops up the hydrogen, which is a very small molecule. It's a weight of 2, and oxygen is a heavy molecule, a weight of 16, so it's too big to fit into the sponge. By the time the nickel is 82% full of hydrogen, absorbed it, the hydrogen begins to combine with the nickel and form copper. And, of course, the scientists hate this because, you know, you're not supposed to be able to do that.
At low voltage anyway, huh?
And that's
is
right.
Is that a transmutation or what?
Transmutation, right. And when that was suggested...
You're referring to a low voltage DC current doing
right. it. But it's a very simple arrangement. Nickel has a weight of 58.7. And if you add 5 hydrogens to it, that gives you a weight of 63.7. copper has a weight of 63.5, which leaves you with 2/10 of nucleons left over. And if you go to Einstein's equation, E equals mc squared, excuse me, I choked something down a little while ago here. If you go to E equals mc squared, energy equals the mass times the square of the speed of light, which is a huge number. The little mass that's lost, 2/10 of a nucleon per operation, becomes a huge amount of heat. And Dr. Patterson demonstrated a cold fusion cell about the size of a coffee mug, and he had 1 watt of electricity going in and 1,000 watts of heat coming out for several days.
So he demonstrated this at the conference you went to?
He demonstrated this at an energy conference.
A watt in and 1,000 watts out.
Right.
And so what's the practical application of such a device?
Well, something like that, let's say you develop a practical unit for it and you have something in the house about the size of a dishwasher, and it would generate all of the heat and the electricity that a family could use. No more power grid going across the country. No more nuclear power plants. No more gas, no more electricity, no more gas, no more
heating oil.
Heating oil.
Coal-fired, mercury-producing.
Exactly.
And so on and so on.
So you're going to put trillions of dollars of business out of business.
So it is what you would call a disruptive technology.
Very.
Now.
And we're talking energy at about between a 20th and a 50th the cost of oil.
Yeah. And is this something that gets used up? Does it?
No. Jim Patterson said, well, you probably have to refurbish this once every 100 years.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
So it is close to free energy as you could ask for, huh?
Exactly. You know, never mind all your sunlight and your wind and waves and other sources of energy. This is the way it's got to go.
Now, what about applying this to a vehicle? How would you move a vehicle down the road with this technology?
Well, I would have a little unit in there that is generating the heat, and I'd have that driving an electric generator, which would put power to the wheels.
To an electric vehicle.
An electric vehicle, right.
So you could take an existing EV and install in the trunk or whatever, instead of a battery pack, install one of these units.
Yep. But, you know, they'd start making new cars with them right away.
So what became of it? You said you started a publication announcing. You were so enthused about what you saw that you started a magazine. Is that it?
That's right. I started a Cold Fusion journal.
What was that called?
Cold Fusion.
Oh, Cold Fusion. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And
I wasn't very inventive on that.
What was the distribution on that?
I put it on the newsstands all over the country at $10 a copy, and it sold out. It was doing pretty good. And
that was years ago, so $10 a copy back then was really quite a bit.
Yeah. Well, this is 1994.
I see, so you were talking 13 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And you continued to publish it for two
well,
years.
Well, I published it. I got 3 issues out, and as I say, Gene Malov was the editor. And we came in one day to start working on the 4th issue. Well, we'd done quite a bit of work already. And I came in, and the office was empty. Everything had been cleaned out. All the files, everything.
Huh. And what was responsible for that?
Gene Malov. He started his own magazine.
Really?
Yep.
And he
took my 4th issue and started his magazine.
And that's what became Infinite Energy?
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
That's where my articles went, and the whole works.
So you were double-crossed?
Yep.
Huh. Isn't that interesting?
Well, I continued on with a more modest version.
In competition now.
For another 25 issues.
Yeah.
And eventually we ran out of anything really of news to publish.
Very interesting. whereas Mr. Maloff continued publishing Infinite Energy up until the time of his death. In fact, it's still being published, isn't it?
I don't know. Might be.
Did you continue to keep in touch with him?
Nope. No, that kind of broke it.
Okay. So what was your reaction upon hearing of his untimely death?
I was not surprised because I knew that he had been trying to organize a congressional hearing on the subject. And, I said at the time, said, you just don't do that. You know, it's bad enough that you're publishing something that could put several trillion-dollar businesses out of business. But, if you start getting really important, you're going to get your head cut off.
So
I've stayed under the radar.
Right. Now, he sent an open letter to the world not
mm-hmm.
long before his death,
mm-hmm.
in which he urged people of all countries and political persuasions and religions and so on to jump on the cold fusion bandwagon.
Sure. Jim Patterson also, I have a tape of him being on Good Morning America, where he not only demonstrated his cell, but he demonstrated another one which used radioactive waste for fuel and decontaminated it. So we don't have to bury all that stuff out there in the mountain of Nevada at, a huge billions and billions of dollars of cost.
So you're saying that this is another evidence of transmutation then?
Absolutely.
The neutralizing of nuclear
sure.
waste.
Oh, it's so simple to demonstrate the validity of transmutation. Anybody can do it on the kitchen table. Take two carbon bars. You remember the old number 6 dry cell?
Yeah, sure.
The big one,
where
it had a big carbon...
With the two springs for contacts.
Right. You take it apart and take the carbon rod out and put a voltage on there and rub the two carbon rods together. And little particles will come off. And you put them on a piece of paper and then run a magnet near there and some of them will jump.
And so...
That's iron from carbon.
So you have converted carbon into iron.
That's right.
Well, that's interesting.
And it's easy to do. And there's a book by Monsieur Cushy on the subject.
Is that a well-known experiment?
Well, it depends. I don't know how well-known it is, but it's provable easily by anybody.
And that's simply by rubbing two carbon rods together that have an applied voltage.
Mm-hmm.
Very interesting. Now, what about some other tabletop demonstrations of cold fusion?
I don't know of that many of them.
Well,
there's a few, but
presented at the museum that I had opened here in Kentucky for
mm-hmm.
a year, which involved the use of two rods, one stainless and one thoriated tungsten.
Mm-hmm.
And a spoonful of baking powder, not baking soda, but baking powder added to distilled water, and then applying upwards of 200 volts AC.
Mm-hmm. So what did you get out of it?
Well, sparks flew.
Oh, okay.
Between those...
Did it generate more energy out than in?
Supposedly. I mean,
okay.
I had no way of calibrating
sure.
the difference, but the water began boiling and...
All right. Have you heard of sonofusion?
Sono, is that something like sonoluminescence?
Mm-hmm.
Supposedly that goes back to the 1800s, even before the advent of electricity.
Well, it might. There was a chap, where was it? Down in New Jersey, I guess, that had invented a way to generate steam heat by compressing water. And he had a wheel with little dimples in it, and he poured water in and then crushed the water in the dimples as the wheel spun around.
Are you speaking of recently?
Yeah.
Okay, that would be a guy down in Georgia, perhaps.
Oh, Georgia, maybe. Okay,
yeah.
Anyway, he was getting more than 100% out.
Using what would be called water hammer.
Right.
Replicating of water hammer.
Yeah. And I sent Maloff down, and he did a report on it. But at any rate, yeah, we've got several examples of those things. But, cold fusion works, and Patterson got some patents on it before they wised up.
Now, what became of him?
We don't know. He disappeared.
He disappeared?
Yeah.
From where?
I don't know.
Had you ever been in communication with him?
Not since he disappeared, no.
But I mean, you had been prior to his...
Oh, sure. I went down, visited him, talked to him at his home, and so forth, sure.
So where was he living?
In Sarasota, Florida.
Sarasota, when he was elderly?
Yep, he's my age.
Okay, yeah, what you...
I mean, that's old. I'm 85.
Yeah, well, you really sound quite healthy for...
I'm doing pretty good.
Yeah, I hope you continue to enjoy the kind of health that you obviously
Well, I
have.
Preach health. You know, I've got a book called The Secret Guide to Health, which I hope some people will be interested in going to my website and finding out about, WayneGreen.com.
Sure, WayneGreen.com. That's Wayne, W-A-Y-N-E.
Right.
Green, just like the color green,
mm-hmm.
.com.
Yep.
And
my book will explain how you can cure Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, cancer, anything like that. And put the $2 trillion, going on $3 trillion, medical industry out of business.
Well, we don't necessarily want to put them out of business, but we just don't want them...
We want to save them just for accidents.
Yeah, we don't want them misleading us into thinking that
right.
their brand of medicine is the best thing for us.
Every illness that we have, we do to ourselves. All of these chronic illnesses, diabetes and so forth, easily cured.
Well, people have to want to change their behavior, and that's...
Yeah.
True with regard to alternative health.
Well, you've got to go to a raw food diet and stop the poisons. You know, no more nicotine, caffeine, alcohol, sugar, white flour products, and things that we know are poisonous.
Yeah, and I wouldn't necessarily agree with you on all those things. I think
if you did your research.
But a moderate dose of caffeine or alcohol isn't necessarily harmful.
Okay, and I guess a moderate dose of any poison isn't
harmful.
Well,
that's true, too. In fact, Paracelsus, the man who discovered hydrogen from acid and metals and
mm-hmm.
500 years ago, he said that it is the dose that makes the poison. And
right.
That's true.
Well, with caffeine. If you take one drop of pure caffeine and inject it into your body, it will kill you.
And if I could do
one drop
of that each morning, I would.
Mm-hmm.
But as he said, the dose is what makes it poisonous, right?
Well, it's very addictive, as most poisons are.
Yeah, as tomorrow morning will demonstrate for most of our listeners. But there are some things that can be partaken of in moderation and others that should be avoided altogether.
Depends on how much you want to knock your immune system out.
Yeah, that could be true. In other words, there can be...
Every poison rushes out the white cells to fight it, and down goes your immune system.
Well, the fact is that no matter what we do to our bodies, we still grow old and die. We don't have to be quite so miserable in our old age.
Well, we are cutting our lives about in half. If we treated our bodies right, we'd live 120 to 200 years. And in good health.
And I believe that endless life is actually what is possible for mankind. I think our bodies are capable of actually rejuvenating themselves forever if the right conditions were met.
No, it might be.
And
we haven't tried that yet.
I don't think anything we can eat or avoid eating is going to give us that.
Well, if we ate the nutrition that our bodies were designed to use and had all of the vitamins and the minerals in it that used to be in there when this design was firmed up... we'd be in good health.
Yeah, and I think there's a spiritual element also that is definitely missing and that has to be addressed because we're sick in more ways than one. And I don't think you can have perfect health if you don't have perfect spirituality, really. I think that's...
Well, I don't know what you mean by spirituality, but I do know that intention is important.
Well, what I would say with regard to spirituality is that we didn't just happen. Therefore, there's a maker who's responsible for our existence, and if we're...
Oh, yeah, I've written a book on that.
Yeah, so if we're out of sync with his, with his purpose, our lifespan is deliberately short.
Yeah. Our God, or whatever you want to call it, is not a superannuated Santa Claus keeping track of how good or bad we are. So we keep track of that.
Well, people seem to be paying even now, as you're saying about health. You know,
mm-hmm.
People ruin their own health. They really are reaping what they're sowing in their own personal life.
Oh, sure. Stress is bad. And one of the things, you know, in my book, I say, look, you want to get out and do some fast walking every day? Make sure your glasses are off so you get the sunlight in your eyes so that you can generate the vitamin D that you need. And listen to some classical music every day.
That's a good suggestion. I'll take
sure.
that.
Sure.
Now let me.
And if people aren't familiar with the classics, I have a book said, "Look, here's the best of them." There's an awful lot of junk classical music out there, but here's the good ones.
Yeah, you know, it seems like the local university radio station plays a lot of it. I hear a lot of the classical music being played on some of the NPR radio stations, and it really is junk.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of really beautiful music, classical music, moving music, but you don't hear it on the radio.
Well, I published the top music magazine in the country, and I heard all the new classical music as it was being, you know, produced. And there wasn't anything coming out in the last 50 years that was worth hearing twice, much less once.
Yeah. Well, as Duke Ellington said, music is either good or bad. And you'll know when you take a listen to it, whether it's got a pleasing melody and so on.
Sure. No, some pieces, you know, I remember the first time I ever heard Gottschalk's Tarantella. I said, wow. Wow.
I'll have to try that one. Gottschalk's Tarantella, huh?
Oh, sure.
Okay, I'll type that in and see if I can't get a listen to it. But let's spend the last few minutes of our program discussing something that you mentioned when we talked earlier, and that is you used the expression Illuminati.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, you believe that...
I don't believe in anything. Let's take that word out of the language.
You have discovered
because
that there is a group of people that's responsible for a lot of the suppression of good technology.
Sure.
And so based on your age and experience, I'd like you to expound on that for us.
Okay. There are a group of families that run the Federal Reserve, are the large stockholders in the pharmaceutical industry. They own the major media, the major newspapers of the country, and the radio and television networks, and they control them all. And they have helped set up the school system, which guarantees that we're going to be obedient and not think. And I hope to totally sabotage all of that. I think I've made good steps toward that with the cell phone first, which brought personal communications to everybody. Secondly, with the computer, which brought us the web and made it so that we have a source of information other than that is controlled by this small group of people.
So you are saying that the Internet has to be really hated by these people.
Oh, Lordy, and they wish they could do something about it, but even China hasn't been able to stop it.
But they have censored it.
They've tried.
They have succeeded in keeping people from being able to search certain
subjects
and so on. What do you suspect could happen to the Internet if these people had their way?
Well, my next step is to start a magazine and to get somebody busy making, programs which will help families have genius children. We know how to increase the IQ of children by about 50 points now over what they normally would be. We know how to do that, and I've written about it. And I want to get that information out there and say, okay, here's DVDs or memory chips or whatever that have the program in there. Here's how you want to go about having a very intelligent child. Here's what you do step by step by step through pregnancy, and then the first few months of birth and so after birth and so forth. And if you go by this program, you're going to have average 150 IQ children. We know how to teach kids to read books at a few seconds a page with total comprehension. And you can go to speedreadingforkids.com with the number 4 in there and see how they're doing it.
Now, do you think getting a kid a box of radio parts also plays a role in expanding?
It sure does. And imagine if kids are able to learn anything that they want because they want. Well, we have a school down here in Framingham, Massachusetts, called the Sudbury Valley School, that has no curriculum. And the kids are from 4 years old to 20, and they learn what they want because they want to. And they help teach each other, and the results are spectacular. And the school costs less than half that of any of the other government schools.
Very interesting. Well, I've tried to advocate on this program the need for parents to expose their children to mechanical skills.
Mm-hmm.
And similar to your generation, children grew up making models.
Sure.
They weren't playing video games. They weren't watching TV. And... those are the people who, even in their older age, such as yourself, are still doing things relating to inventing, promoting technologies that are beyond the scope of what the average younger person would even think about.
Sure.
People now in this country don't think in terms of inventing or discovering a solution to a mechanical problem.
They, right. Now, I think I was seven when my folks gave me a chemistry set, a very nice one. And boy, did I have fun.
Okay, so there you go. And that just ain't happening anymore.
Right.
As far as I can tell, parents are not giving their children. Like, for instance, one of my guests said his father required him and his twin brother to disassemble their brand-new bicycles before they could ride them,
mm-hmm.
to take them entirely apart and put them back together again.
Yeah.
So they would appreciate what they have.
Well, I was doing things like that and taking clocks apart and putting them back together and so forth when I was, you know, 7, 8, 9 years old.
And then the problem is the products that were being given by these, you know, these Chinese-made products,
mm-hmm.
all say no user serviceable parts inside.
Right.
So even if you did know how to work on something, you still couldn't work on your VCR, your CD player, whatever it is, right?
Well, we'll get some new kits out there.
Yeah, so we're living in a world that's moving further away from people being able to actually have a hands-on
mm-hmm.
participation in the products that they use.
Sure.
Right? Cars now have a cover over the engine compartment. You know that?
Yeah.
Where you can't even see the engine. It's like a black box.
Sure. Yeah.
So, wouldn't you say that that's something...
We're going to sabotage that whole thing.
Yeah, so you feel like we have to go back to a simpler technology to experience more...
Mm-hmm. My magazine will be a review by the readers, just what I did with my compact disc magazine. When the compact disc came out, the music magazines and the hi-fi magazines all said, oh, we don't need another. You know, we're always going to have LPs. We don't need CDs. And I said, baloney. And I started CD Review Magazine. And I had my readers review every CD that they bought for sound quality and performance. And the result was that those that got a 10-10 rating sold like crazy. And it forced the major... record companies to totally rebuild their studios to turn out CD sound instead of LP sound. And they hated it, but they said, well, we have to advertise in your magazine because your readers are spending $30 million a month on CDs.
Wow. Amazing. Well, we have just a few minutes remaining. What would you encourage listeners to do with regard to...
Start learning.
That's a good start, isn't it?
Start learning.
They have by listening to your interview.
If they go to my website, they'll see my Secret Guide to Health, which will teach them about that. My Secret Guide to Wealth, which says, look, here's how you can make all the money you want. And my Secret Guide to Wisdom, which is a review of about 100 books that you absolutely must read.
Well, it sounds like a worthy investigation. And again, they can go to waynegreen.com to find those
right.
lists.
And you get my phone number and my address there, and I'm available.
So there is contact information available on your
yep.
website. Very good. Well, it's been nice having you, and I'm going to spend the remaining couple minutes informing the public that there is a new web page that has a list of all the shows that have been recorded on this program.
Mm-hmm.
People have complained they haven't been able to find them all by going to Blog Talk Radio. So someone has very lovingly downloaded all of these interviews on a particular site, and that would be waterfueltech.com.
Mm-hmm.
Waterfueltech.com. At that site, you can find all the shows that have been recorded on this program, many interesting, enlightening interviews with people such as Mr. Green. Now, our contact email address is waterfuelmuseum@yahoo.com. waterfuelmuseum@yahoo.com. And incidentally, our email address is also our PayPal account number. So if a person would like to receive, for instance, the first book written on the history of turning water into fuel, it's available for $22. That includes shipping in the U.S., $28 international. And that includes a DVD with interviews of water fuel device inventors. So, Mr. Green, I'd like to thank you for joining us. I'm sure that people will enjoy this interview and want to hear from you again.
Well, thank you for having me, and maybe we can get on again and explain and talk about the total baloney that we're getting over global warming.
Yeah, that sounds very interesting.
What a crock.
I'm looking forward to going to your website and checking out some of the information that's available there.
Good deal.
All right, thanks so much.
Righto, James.
Take care.
Right.
Bye-bye.